Sweet promises given to all who believe. Behold, I come quickly, mine own to receive. Hold fast till I come, the danger is great. Sleep not as do others, be watchful and wait. Hold fast till I come, sweet promise of heaven. The kingdom restored to you shall begin. Come, enter my joy, sit down on my throne. Bright crowns are in waiting. Hold fast till I come. We'll watch unto prayer with lamps burning bright. He comes to all others, a thief in the night. We know he is near, but know not the day. As spring shows that summer is not far away. Hold fast till I come, sweet promise of heaven. The kingdom restored to you shall begin. Come enter my joy, sit down on my throne. Bright crowns are in waiting. Hold fast till I come. Yes, this is our hope, 'tis built on his word, the glorious appearing of Jesus our Lord. Of promises all, it stands as the sum. Behold, I come quickly. Hold fast till I come. Hold fast till I come, sweet promise of heaven. The kingdom restored to you shall begin. Come enter my joy, sit down on my throne. Bright crowns are in waiting. Hold fast till I come.
In the days of John, God handpicked seven literal churches that would typify seven stages of church history. The past, the present, the future of the church is all mapped out in the letters to the seven churches. Rebukes, warning, reproofs, remedies, and Satan's strategies all laid bare. Tune into Rugged Adversity on Mondays at 7 p.m. to see the history behind church history.
Hello friends, greetings wherever you are listening from. This is Wake It Out with Yuana and Babu Kimoseki. I'll be taking you through the Church of Philadelphia. In our last study, we were looking at the Church of Sardis. So what do we know about Philadelphia? Remember that these were city churches. When you read the book of Revelation, chapter 2, chapter 3, these were actually places that existed back then under those names, and they had churches, and these letters were sent to these churches. So the church in Philadelphia also received a letter of its own. So the city was located about 28 kilometers southeast of Sardis, and it was founded in 189 BC by Attalus Philadelphus, for whom it was named. So it was named after the founder, and some believe that it was so named also because of the love and loyalty existing between Philadelphus and his brother, the king of Lydia. And it was also known as Decapolis because it was one of the 10 cities of the plain, and it was sometimes called Little Athens because of the magnificence of its public buildings. So it had different names, basically. It was known by different names. And the city, the way it was located, it guarded and commanded an important pass through the mountains between the Hermus and Meander valleys. It was thus the keeper of the key to the door or gateway to the eastern highlands, with the power to open and close according to the will of the officials. In other words, in order for you to go to the Eastern Highlands, you have to pass through Philadelphia. And so it acted as a key. You know, it would, they could either allow you to pass or deny you passage. So through this portal, you know, the mail, trade, and commerce of the West to the wide range of Central and Eastern Lydia are passed. So whether it's delivered mail, they have to pass through Philadelphia. Whether it's trade and commerce, they have to pass through Philadelphia. So it acted as a key, either to open or to lock, to give access or to deny access to the other side. And then there's another element about the city of Philadelphia. It was subject to frequent and severe earthquakes. In his book, Strabo says that Philadelphia has no trust with walls, but daily, in one direction or another, they keep tottering and falling apart. The inhabitants, however, pursue their original purpose, ever keeping in mind the rhythm pains of the ground and building with a view to counteracting them. And because of this situation, the people often fled to the open country and lived in tents during earthquake seasons in order to keep themselves beyond the range of disaster. And when you look at verse 12 of Revelation chapter 3, which is still a message to the church of Philadelphia, it says something very interesting. It says, "Him that overcometh will I make a pillar in the temple of my God, and he shall go no more out." Now underline that. The one who overcomes will be made a pillar in the temple of God, and because he's made a pillar, he will go no more out. So they will never have to constantly go out. That is the promise that, you know, you, if you overcome, you'll not be having this experience of going in and out like you are used to in Philadelphia. So you are speaking to something that they understood. He was using a language that they understood, looking at that situation. And then he related that to the spiritual to the spiritual state and give this promise. So that is what we see right there. Now we will go into the text itself, which starts from verse 7 all the way to verse 13. Reading from verse 7, it says, "And to the angel of the church in Philadelphia write, this thing saith he that is holy, he that is true, he that has the key of David, he that opens and none shall shut, and that shutteth and none openeth." So we see in verse 7 Christ introducing himself to the church of Philadelphia, or the church in Philadelphia, as the one that is holy, the one that is true, the one that has the key of David. Verse 8, "I know thy works. Behold, I have set before thee a door opened, which none can shut." And remember, this is the same one with the key of David in verse 7. "That you have a little power and did keep my word and did not deny my name." So here we see the commendation, you know, the acknowledgement of what they have done. And then it says in verse 9, "Behold, I give of the synagogue of Satan, of them that say they are Jews and they are not, but do lie. Behold, I will make them to come and worship before your feet and to know that I have loved you. Because you did keep the word of my patience, I also will keep you from the hour of trial, that hour which is to come upon the whole world, to try them that dwell upon the earth. I come quickly, hold fast that which you have, and that no man or that no one take your crown." Verse 12, "He that overcomes, I will make him a pillar in the temple of my God, and he shall go out thence no more, and I will write upon him the name of my God and the name of the city of my God, the new Jerusalem, which comes down out of heaven from my God, and my own new name. He that has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. So we see here that in this letter to the church in Philadelphia, there is no rebuke. There is nothing that he has against them. It's all acknowledgement and also a promise to those who overcome, and a promise to keep them from the hour of trial that is to come upon the whole world. That is what we see there in the message to the church of Philadelphia, as we're reading from verse 7 to verse 13. Now we are going to break it down so that we can observe certain things and see how this plays out in a worldwide scale, in a spiritual worldwide scale, looking at the church as it has gone through the seven periods of, or seven epochs in its existence. Now, when you look at the Church of Sardis, it spanned from 1798, which is basically the end of the Church of Thyatira, 1798 until 1833. So that is the period for the Church of Sardis. Now, when you look at the period for the Church of Philadelphia, it stretches from 1833 to 1844. We actually understand why we say 1844. When you look at the next church, which is the final church, the Church of Laodicea. But that is just to, you know, give you an idea as to what period of time you're talking about when you look at the worldwide spiritual application of the Church of Philadelphia. So it is basically a very short span of time, about 11 years actually, 11 years, 1832 to 1844. This about right there, 11 years, and that's what we'll be looking at, the things that characterized the church during the period between 1833 and 1844. Looking at verse 7, Christ says that it is he that is holy. He's introducing himself as the one that is holy and that is true. Now, when you look at Revelation chapter 6, verse 10, I'm talking about the creatures around the throne. He says, and they cried with a loud voice, saying, how long? Actually, these are the souls, rather. The souls under the altar. That is what you see right there. It says, how long, O Lord, holy and true, dost thou not judge and avenge our blood on them that dwell on the earth? So we see that this phrase, holy and true, is connected with the judgment, is connected with avenging. So Jesus presents himself as he who will judge the world. Right there in the Church of Philadelphia, he's basically giving a message that judgment is coming and I'm the one who's going to be judging. So that is the encoded message in the title that is being used here by Jesus Christ, in that it is he that is holy and that is true. So that is what we see. And then another phrase is, he that has the key of David. He that has the key of David. We know that keys are used to open or unlock something that was previously locked. So they are used to unlock or lock. They give you access. And this is that it is he that has the key of David. In the book of Isaiah chapter 22, verse 22, it says, and the key of the house of David will I lay upon his shoulder. So he shall open and none shall shut, and he shall shut and none shall open. Very, very interesting. So the key of the house of David is laid on his shoulder. What else goes to the shoulder of Christ? Let's still go, or still in the book of Isaiah. Let's now go to chapter 9. It says in verse 6 of chapter 9, for unto us a child is born, unto us a child is given, and the government shall be upon his shoulder. So we see the key of the house of David is upon his shoulder, or will be laid upon his shoulder. Isaiah 22, verse 22. And in Isaiah chapter 9, verse 6, talking about Christ or Jesus, he says that the government shall be upon his shoulder. So that is what we see. Now, what happens basically in the house of David? Now, remember, so Christ is given the government. Christ is the one who is given a rulership according to Isaiah chapter 9, verse 6. And Isaiah 22, verse 22 says that he's given the keys to the house of David. He has the key of the house of David. Now, what happens in the house of David? What do you find in the house of David? Psalm 122 verse 5, he says, "For there are set thrones of judgment, the thrones of the house of David." So thrones of judgment are in the house of David. Therefore, this key is to open the house of judgment. We see still here with this phrase that Christ is giving us a message that judgment is about to begin. And he gives this message during the time of the Church of Philadelphia. So that is what we see. The Bible is just interesting. And also, you when you look at how did he gain, how did he have the key of David, you know? So the key of David is basically the power that Jesus has gained by his incarnation and his death to begin the work of investigative judgment. I mean, incarnation, death, resurrection, of course. And that is how he basically gained that key, or possessed that key, so that he can begin the work of investigative judgment. In the book of John chapter 5, verse 27, it says, and has given to him of the Father, he says, and has given him authority to execute judgment also, because he is the Son of Man. So the Father has given the Son, he's given Jesus Christ, authority to execute judgment. Why? Because he, Jesus, is the Son of Man. So that is what we see. So because he has tasted the very dregs of human affliction and temptation and understands the frailties and sins of men, because in our behalf, he, that is Jesus, has victoriously withstood the temptations of Satan and will deal justly and tenderly with the souls that his own blood has been poured out to save. Because of this, he is appointed to execute judgment. Because he is the high priest who is familiar with the feeling of our infirmities, he is appointed to execute judgment. Very, very interesting. So we see Christ here talking about something that directly is connected to his role as the high priest in the heavenly sanctuary. Now, the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ not only enabled him to be our judge, but it also gave him power to resurrect the dead. In the book of Revelation chapter 1 verse 18, he says, "I am he that liveth and was dead, and behold, I am alive forevermore, amen, and have the keys of hell and of death." So we see a connection here between judgment and the resurrection. Judgment, the judgment that Christ is doing, the judgment that Christ is talking about in the book of, in the message to the Church of Philadelphia, will determine who shall be resurrected to inherit life, eternal life, that is. John chapter 5, verse 27 and 28 says, "But marvel not at this, for the hour is coming in the which all that are in the graves shall hear his voice, and shall come forth. They that have done good unto the resurrection of life, and they that have done evil unto the resurrection of damnation." John 5:28 and 29. So that is what we see right there. And then you get to verse 8. Verse 8, he says, "I know thy works. Behold, I have set before thee an open door, and no man can shut it, for you have a little strength, and has kept my word, and has not denied my name." I know your works. That is what Christ is saying here to this church. So when you look at the church during the time that we spoke about, 1833 to 1844, this is the time when the church entered a program of world evangelism to fulfill the Great Commission. This is what you call the Millerite movement, or the early Advent movement, as it was later known. So this way people were basically preaching all over the world. I mean, you have America, you have Europe, and other South America and other parts of the world where this message of judgment was being preached all over. So and basically you see missions in China as well, by the likes of Robert Morrison. You have the likes of Robert Moffat coming to Africa, David Livingstone as well, coming to Africa. So you see this work that has been done during this period of time, a worldwide awakening, as it were, trying to get people to be ready for Christ. And this is what happened during that time, 1833 to 1844. And it characterizes the Church of Philadelphia. It is a fulfillment of the works that the Church of Philadelphia were doing. And then he says, I have set before thee an open door. The door gives you access or entrance or an opportunity. In the book of Acts, chapter 14, verse 27, and it says, and when they were come and had gathered the church together, they rehearsed all that God had done with them, and how he had opened the door of faith unto the Gentiles. And then 1 Corinthians chapter 16, verse 18, verse 9, but I will tarry at Ephesus until Pentecost. Verse 9, for a great door and effectual is opened unto me, and there are many adversaries. So basically, the door being opened means, you know, an opportunity to preach being availed. In the book of Revelation chapter 11, verse 15 and verse 19, and the seventh angel sounded, and the temple of God was opened in heaven, and there was seen in his temple the ark of his testament. So the opening of the judgment also is being alluded to here. Why? Because remember that he has the keys of David. So, and the keys of David, when they open the house of David, what you find in there is the thrones of judgment. So the judgment house was being opened as well during this time of Philadelphia. It's like it was just the prelude to the opening of the house of judgment. People were being told that judgment is coming. Judgment is coming. William Miller in particular taught that, well, Christ is coming and is going to judge the world, so we have to be ready for that. Now let's move on to verse 9. It says, behold, I will make them of the synagogue of Satan, which say they are Jews and are not, but do lie. Behold, I will make them to come and worship before thy feet, and to know that I have loved you. So who is the synagogue of Satan? Remember, in the Church of Smyrna, there was actually an allusion to the synagogue of Satan. So this is just like Smyrna. This is the preparation for the papacy again. The Protestants from Sardis, who are spiritually dead, who refused to grow, and now they have come to the period of Philadelphia, they become the synagogue of Satan. So they become apostate Protestants. In Smyrna, they laid the foundation for the compromise that followed in Pergamos. So we can expect the same thing here. And then it says, I will make them to come and worship before thy feet. So those who are the synagogue of Satan, of the synagogue of Satan, will come and worship before the feet of the faithful. The church will prevail against her enemies, basically, who made hypocritical pretensions of being God's chosen people. So God is saying, don't worry about them. I will humble them. You, the church, will prevail in spite of the synagogue of Satan. So these are the promises that we see being given to the church of Philadelphia. So just to do a little bit of comparison here, you see, when you look at the nature of the Church of Ephesus, it's similar to the Church of Sardis. The nature is basically more or less the same, and this manner squares up well and nicely with Philadelphia. And then Pergamos and Thyatira, one side, you see in the future that they square up with the characteristics of Laodicea. So these are the observations, basically, when you look at the seven churches in total. Just as a side note, we now continue with the next point, which is from verse 10. It says, because thou hast kept the word of my patience, I also will keep thee from the hour of temptation, which shall come upon all the world to try them that dwell upon the earth. Now, in Smyrna, temptation is tribulation. And when you look at the greatest temptation that the Advent movement had, it was the great disappointment of 1844. Temptation basically means adversity or affliction, which is also connected to disappointment. In the book of Luke chapter 8, verse 10, it says, when they hear, receive the word with joy, in time of temptation, fall away. Okay, let's just read that in full so that I don't make short the things that should be in full. This is part of the parable of the sower. It says, they on the rock are they which, when they hear, receive the word with joy, and these have no root, which for a while believe, and in time of temptation, in time of testing or trial, fall away. So I wanted to emphasize that that word temptation means trial. So it's like these are people who are disappointed. Why? Because this is basically a plant or a seed that fell on a stony place. On stony places, when the sun comes up, it's like it's a disappointment to it, and then it dies. It becomes weak. So that is what we see right there. The temptation is, in this context, the disappointment, something that was not expected, and just something that somehow gave them a bitter experience, if you will. And then as we prepare to wrap up, let's look at verse 11. Behold, I come quickly. Hold fast that which you have, that no man take your crown. So we see the language of the second coming here. This is second coming language. James chapter 1 verse 18, blessed is he, or is the man that endures temptation, for when he is tried, he shall receive the crown of life. So this crown is a crown of life, which the Lord has promised to them that love him. So when the people of Philadelphia endure the temptation or disappointment, they will get the crown. They will get the crown of life that is promised there in James 1 verse 13. Enduring temptation means that you have to be patient. You don't have to give up, but you have to hold on and not lose hope and faith. Verse 12, him that overcometh will I make a pillar in the temple of my God, and he shall go no more out, and I'll write upon him the name of my God, and the name of the city of my God, which is New Jerusalem, which comes down out of heaven from my God, and I'll write upon him my new name. Now, we did make an allusion to this earlier on, that, they used to go in and out because of the earthquake, the earthquakes that plagued the city of Philadelphia. But now here we see that the one who overcomes, the going in and out, the one who overcomes, the one who endures the temptation or the trial, the one who does not give up when they've gone through the disappointment, when they're going through that great disappointment, this very one will be established. There will be a pillar in the temple of God. So that is what we see right there. So they shall be one of the great and beautiful stones on which the others rest. They shall be placed in such a way that they cannot be removed. They will be eternally secure in God's presence. They'll be eternally secure in God's kingdom. That is the promise. And then he says, I will write upon him the name of my God. Now, name signifies character. So the character of Christ will be given them. The character of Christ will be given them. So that is what we see in the message to the church of Philadelphia. And in verse 18, he that has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. So God wants us, he uses this cryptic statement at every end of the message that he gives to one of the seven churches. every message, he uses that cryptic statement, which means that now the Spirit is speaking to us today. Although we don't live in that period of 1833 to 1844, we are past that, but there are certain elements that we can identify with in the message to the Church of Philadelphia that we need to take heed of, and we need to align our lives and our will with God's will, so that we may benefit from the promises that were given to the Church in Philadelphia. May God bless you, friends. Thank you so much for listening to this discussion. I hope that it has added some value to your knowledge of the message to the Church of Philadelphia. May God bless you.